My name's Tim Phillips. I'm director of Lion Arc, and this is Lazy Dog Film.
We had another premiere for Lion's Arc recently. I don't know if you remember, but I interviewed you back in 2013.
I do. I remember the name Lazy Dog Films.
I reviewed the film then, and I got to interview you, and I got to interview your wife as
Dan.
Well, or at least I spoke to her. I remember.
Yeah. It's all gone pretty well since then.
Okay.
Should I talk through what's happening with Lion Arc?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Where's it been from when I interviewed you back in 2013?
That was the very beginning of our film festival run, and it went down really well on the film festival circuit, and we got picked up 6 awards, 3-4 of them audience choice, so it was really pleasing to see people really enjoying the film. We wanted to make a film about a serious issue, but that people would really enjoy. And so we clocked up quite a few film festivals. We're doing a handful now. During the late summer, we've signed a worldwide distribution deal with ITB Global Entertainment.
Mm-hmm. And what else have they done?
They're a huge TV producer. I mean, ITV is sort of famous, I suppose, for Downton Abbey and series like that, and nature series like River Monsters they distribute. I think one of the biggest suppliers of TV output in the US now. And we showcased the film with them at Cannes at MIPCOM, and it was one of their top 10 picks. So we were up there with amongst the 10 things they were really promoting was the brand new ABC David Duchovny cop series, and a couple of period dramas, and Lion Arc was the only documentary in there. So that was very exciting, and we've had interest for TV sales from as far afield as Korea to France to South America. We should start seeing Lion Arc on TV, we hope, in the coming months, probably April onwards. We're doing a few more theatrical screenings with it. The ITV deal is for all the TV rights, video on demand, DVD, Blu-ray.
I wanted to know, what does it feel like to get a deal with ITV and being at so many different film festivals, especially with this being your first film? Because I know you do animal rescues, especially like we saw in the film where you go and you help rescue these lions from a circus. What does it feel like going to so many film festivals? Like you said, Cannes. What does that feel like?
Well, it's been kind of quite an amazing journey, really. I mean, the great thing is we've been doing the Q&As after the film, and often we'll be at a film festival and people say, "Are you doing a Q&A?" We'll go, yes, we'll do a Q&A, and they'll go, "Yeah." It usually lasts about 5-10 minutes, a few questions, and ours normally go on for sort of 30-45 minutes with the film festival organizers saying, "Okay, you better wrap it up." We've done a few where no one leaves the theater. They just want more and more and more. And I think the big part of our main work, which is Animal Defenders International, is communicating. So to be doing that has been fantastic. And for people to appreciate the film on both an awareness level and a story level, but also the artistic level, to have won Best Documentary up in Omaha and in Mississippi and places, that's been terrific too. And I must say, when we went to MIPCOM in Cannes, which is this vast TV buying market. I mean, it really is huge. It, mm-hmm. it takes over the whole of the front, and there's people like Simon Cowell and everyone down there. We were up in Lima on the rescue of the lions and things, and we were there up in our compound, and it really is the sort of grittiest, grubbiest, sweatiest, dirtiest part of our work. And we got on an aircraft, flew back to London, flew down to France, went and spoke to people about the film at Cannes, which was all gloss and glitz and parties on the beach. And then the next Friday we got back on the plane, went back to our gritty lion compound where we've got 20 plus rescued lions. So it was very surreal in many ways, but very, very exciting. And I think it's just so pleasing that people are enjoying the film so much.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think that there's such a, I guess, a certain way of, or people enjoying the film? Why do you think that is? Is it because of the incredible journey that you take, or is it something else?
I think above all else, it's the story. And it was the first time we really wanted to do something that was feature length, because we felt the story would fill 90 minutes. In fact, it quite easily filled 3 hours. We had to keep cutting back. But I think there's two big factors in that. The way it explores the issue is kind of through the animal's eyes instead of through people talking about the misery of the animals. And the journey of the lions is one of becoming lions again, that you don't need to dwell on the suffering, because the minute you see them rolling about in hay for the first time and playing with toys, you realize how awful it was that there was none of those things before. And with each step, you realize just what they were denied, but it's kind of in an uplifting way, because they're putting behind them the life they led. I think it's an exciting story that it was well filmed. I think our team on it did a great job. They were right in there with the action. We filmed with a very stripped back film crew, so that, you know, it was just cameramen with onboard mics and a couple of radio mics, so it was very intrusive. So when people are there, they feel right in the thick of the action. And I think that's very rare for a documentary, which is often outsiders just coming in and taking in a way a snapshot of something that's happening. And I think that's drawn in audiences. I do think above all else it was an amazing story to go to Bolivia and rescue all of these animals from such varied circumstances, and then this huge journey first for them to recover, and then flying to Colorado and finally seeing them free. It's almost the sort of perfect animal rescue story, and with highs, lows, and lots of drama throughout. So I think above all else, I hope people enjoy, and I think they do, the way it was edited, kind of in an action-adventure style. But I honestly think above all else, people respond to the fact this is a great story. And I think if you were sitting in a bar and someone said, "Tell us about that film," most people would go, "That sounds an interesting story."
Yeah. And the way it is shot, it does feel like a reality TV show, in the sense that the cameras are in the thick of everything, but it doesn't feel like a reality TV show, in the sense that it's not dramatized in any way. It really does feel visceral, and it does have that sort of tense feeling and suspense when you watch it, hoping and wishing that the lions do make it. And so,
yeah.
No, continue.
Yeah, I think it's very honestly shot, and it's obviously all shot in one take. There was, you know, this is what's happening, you've got to capture it on film. And as someone who was actually there, I think we achieved that very, very well in certain places, and in other places I think people won't realise just how tense that was. And that's the nature of doing everything in one take as it happens. And I think one reviewer said, "It's not an, is it a nature documentary? Is it a serious issue documentary? Is it reality TV? Is it an action adventure?" No, but yes, it's all of these things. And I think it has got kind of all of those elements. It doesn't have that contrivance that I think people are sick of with what we've come to know as reality TV, the sort of contrived arguments and all of those things. But it has the immediacy of being fly on the wall. I think reality TV is sort of distorted a bit, reality TV, if you see what I mean by these kind of contrived formats that deliberately engineer confrontation and so forth. I think we used to call it, you know, decades ago, fly on the wall, and that was always regarded as, this is honest, this is just as things unfold. Mm-hmm. And I guess we film very much in that vein, the fly on the wall vein. And so I think people get to know the Lions very much, they get to know us, and they are in the thick of the action, and that has definitely engaged people. And I think people can see it's very honest. I think some people have been surprised that we were perhaps gentler on the circus owners than we might have been expected to be as campaigners. That we do show where they're upset when they're having animals taken off them. We do show them giving their arguments about, you know, we need our cage back because we can take it apart and use it. And I think all of those things have sort of helped make it be a sort of honest and an exciting story, and people don't, I hope, feel they're being lectured to in any way. Certainly the audiences we've had at film festivals haven't felt that. Mm-hmm.
It's human. It's for a story about lions, it's human.
Yeah.
So the film was originally shot in 2011? 2010?
Yes, late 2010 into 2011.
Okay.
And we actually completed the edit in 2013, the one you saw, and then when we put it into distribution and the one that's in theatres now, we just refined the edit a little bit, took off a few minutes and improved the sound mix in a few places where we felt audiences were struggling, and so it's really was finished in October 2014, but it's not hugely different from the 2013 edit.
Okay, all right. So, with Lion Arc, and with your contributions to other animal rescues, what do you have in store next, if you have it in mind, or if you have anything in mind, what would you would like to accomplish next in a documentary style film, or even a small TV show?
Well, we're in the middle of a really big rescue at the moment, even bigger in many ways than the Lion Arc rescue. Down in Peru, we're enforcing the law there, and we're also simultaneously assisting the Colombian authorities with enforcing the ban. So we've in Peru, we've set up a compound, much as we did in Lion Arc, and we've rescued 21 lions from circuses in some pretty hairy and hair-raising seizures. We've had the riot police and SWAT teams even called in on one. And we've also been rescuing illegally trafficked animals. So we've got over 20 monkeys and other indigenous wildlife. And the lions will be another big airlift to Colorado, same home as the Lion Arc lions. And it's complicated because we've got to pick up 9 lions in Colombia, and we're possibly getting 15 lions from Argentina too, and then we're also constructing homes out in the Amazon forest for all of these monkeys. They can't just be released into the wild, so we're giving them the closest we can, a bit like we did with the lions, and they'll have their own bit of Amazon forest and social contact with their own kind, but they won't be completely running free. So we've been filming again on RED and on very high spec cameras with just, you know, one or two cameramen at a time. And we're in discussions with people about this being a possible TV series. And lots of people have said to me, you're making Lion Ark 2. And Jan and I both feel, well, we did that with Lion Ark. What more could we explore of the what goes into these rescues? And there was much we didn't show in Lion Ark that we did film, which was the sort of the more minutiae of the rescue, which is, you know, certain lions that they're even too scared to come out of their cages, and it can take a whole process of calming measures and slowly luring them out and sort of building their confidence again. And so we also sort of the whole veterinary issues, you know, we've had dental surgery on a couple of the monkeys already to repair terrible damage. One monkey had all his canine teeth snapped off by the circus, and so he needed root canal work to repair that. And similar things happened to the lions, so we have a dental surgeon coming in just a couple of weeks for a couple of lions who are in very serious trouble. And these animals, the lions come at you face first, as you'd expect. So if they're going to get hit, they get hit in the face with metal bars, and they also damage their teeth on metal bars. So circus lions nearly always have a few broken teeth, and those become seriously infected over time, and they can even be lethal to the animals. So we're filming all of those things, sort of not trying to lose the immediacy or try and go for a particular style or format, but we're recording all of that, and we've shot almost 100 hours of footage already. And, you know, even just this building up in the Amazon, we've got to fly up, take some of the materials up by boat up the Amazon on the big ships, and then onto smaller boats that go up to the island where the monkey habitat's been built, and then, you know, carrying over 20 bags of cement through the forest to where we're building the habitat. So it's interesting stuff we're getting, and I think, you know, Jan and I feel it would make a great TV series and explore some of these issues we face in other countries where the authorities are really trying to start resolving these illegal animal trafficking issues, and what resources do they have? What does it take to actually move things forward? So hopefully people will see this in some form or another in the coming year.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to move into a little bit more north. I know you're doing a lot of work now in South America, Peru, and Brazil. Not Brazil, I'm sorry, Bolivia and things like that. Colombia. What about, I don't know if you've heard, or you've probably seen the documentary Blackfish. I know you rescued the lion from these circuses in South America. I want to know, what's your feeling on SeaWorld?
Yeah, I think it's part of the same problem. And I think Blackfish did a very good job of taking that issue to another level, a good example of the power of the documentary to reach a whole new group of people. And it's been a long, long-running campaign by people to stop the use of whales and dolphins in aquatic sea shows. Aquatic shows, and you know, that film has really created some momentum, and obviously it followed the deaths of another trainer, and that in itself has fueled a lot of extra concern. And I think, you know, we're seeing something around the world, whether it's in Europe, whether it's in South America, whether it's in the United States, where people are starting to question how we treat animals generally. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things on that list is, how do we treat animals just to entertain ourselves? And SeaWorld is part of that problem. Should we have these magnificent, intelligent animals in these absolutely basic habitats? No matter how big they build the enclosures, they are just swimming pools that these animals are forced to live in. Mm-hmm. And they need the sea, they need social contact. And really, many of the same arguments that we presented on the use of animals in travelling circuses apply there too. And I think that over time we will see the elimination of exhibits like SeaWorld and the travelling circuses. What comes next after that, as humans, sort of the human-animal relationship evolves still further, we shall see. Mm-hmm. I think it's significant that 30 countries have banned travelling circuses now. And that includes such diverse countries as Australia, Czech Republic, Belgium, Portugal, Croatia, and Europe. UK is on the brink of a ban, has been for some time. In Asia, China has started to bring in rules, but they're not enforced. You've also got Taiwan and Singapore. In South America, massive progress with five countries there, Bolivia, Colombia, Paraguay, Ecuador. Brazil has legislation in the upper house at the moment. In Central America, it began small with Costa Rica passing a ban, but they were followed by Panama and El Salvador. And historically, at the end of last year, Mexico, the biggest country so far to ban use of wild animals in circuses. Now, those are very different socio-economic countries, very different public attitudes towards the use of animals in all of those countries. Mm-hmm. But they're all drawing a line and saying, you should not treat wild animals this way. And that's going to happen in America, that's going to happen in Great Britain, and it's going to happen in more and more countries. It really is just a matter of time, because people know that you should not have lions and tigers on the backs of trucks and elephants in chains just to amuse people. Mm-hmm. And that same argument applies to the orcas in SeaWorld and the dolphin shows and all of those as well. And it may not happen suddenly, and it may take a lot of work, but it will happen. I think that everything tells us this is a change that's coming. And I think that films like Lion Art, films like Blackfish are part of that change.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you, what is your stance on hunting, like regulation hunting? Recently here in Florida, there was a ban on hunting black bears that was passed in 94, and now since there is they feel that there's an overpopulation of bears, we're given the okay from the government to hunt them in terms of population control. I don't know if that'll fall into the same category as what you do with the animals in Colombia or in Bolivia, but I wanted to know what your opinion is on that.
Yeah, I don't think it falls into quite the same category, but it's on the same continuum, that's for sure. I mean, personally, I think we have to stop people killing things for fun, and that hunting is on that line, and that if populations need to be controlled in the same way that with the human race, we need to look at how do we humanely do that, and you know, how do we get imaginative about where, because normally it's a matter of the utter destruction of the animal's habitat people run rampant, and then there's not enough space for the animals, and then there's human-animal conflicts, and then it's kind of like, we've created this problem, but we're going to kill the animals anyhow. So usually we need to dig deeper on these things. Should we be relocating these animals? And I have to say, I don't know specifically about the Florida case. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking in very broad brushstrokes here,
okay.
Which is that usually when people say we have to go and kill animals to control their population, then it's either a sticking plaster or we're not trying hard enough to find a solution that's humane. Because most animal populations will control them themselves eventually, mm-hmm. with food sources, with habitat, with those things, even if it's not immediate. I mean, many species, the number of animals in a litter will drop quite dramatically if food is declining or if habitat is declining and things like that. Not always, but very often. So I think that as a society, we should move away from killing things for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a positive step, just like getting away from the Roman gladiatorial arenas was a positive step.
Well, yeah, and here in Florida, it's been every week there's either a bear attack, someone getting hurt by a bear, getting slashed by a bear, and I believe it was a couple months ago there was even an incident where a dachshund saved his owner by getting basically mauled by a black bear while he ran away. So it's kind of it's a problem here, but it's a pretty common problem here. They tell us to watch out in the front because there could be bears in your backyard or trying to get into your trash. Couple that with some mountain lion incidents that we do have, but the black bear population is rising, and they say that it's actually rising pretty quickly. I don't you've seen some things in the news where you have bears in trees by universities or college campuses.
Right. Well, I think all of these things. I mean, I haven't seen this particular coverage, but I think that we, to a certain degree, we then need to learn to live with wildlife, and that's increasingly a challenge. And that if we want to live in beautiful parts of the world where there is nature and where other animals were living there long before us, we have to find ways of doing that rather than kind of eradicating and eliminating that, because I don't think it's necessarily a density of population issue that causes those sorts of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And people are having to do it in Africa if we're going to protect elephants. You know, ODI has funded elephant-proof fencing because we understand that it is a problem for local farmers. If a herd of elephants walks through their crops, they will have no money for a year. And we need to do what we can, which may be fencing, which may be certain areas, and it may be people adapting their lifestyle. But if we want to live in these places where there's loads and loads of wildlife and to enjoy it and to enjoy that habitat that was once theirs, then there may be adaptations. Now, I'm not saying that it will necessarily be simple. We have to dig deep for those solutions and how we share this world. I know that up in Canada there's big issues with polar bears, especially during the polar bear migrations, and they're probably not as populous as the areas you're talking about, but they have programs of live trapping polar bear jails and release in other places and that kind of thing. There's probably varying degrees of success, but it is about exploring the ways that we can live with wildlife, maybe move wildlife, without killing it, I think.
So, what is your ideal plan in a perfect world? Not in a perfect world, because in a perfect world we wouldn't be having these problems. But in your ideal setting or an idea, what would be the best plan of action with these animals if human population is getting way out of proportion, where you know the world population is increasing daily, and animals are like here in Florida with the black bears there, we're intruding on their habitat, and they're intruding on ours. What would be your ideal way of handling that situation, in terms of giving their own, giving the bears their own environment?
Well, I haven't studied that issue enough to be absolutely specific, but I think I can talk in broad brushstrokes.
Yeah,
where
like with
around
the
world,
animals, or with some of the animals in South America, you know, removing them from the circuses, and you're integrating them back into the wild. What about though? I know you have to have some animals who are either too weak or too old to get assimilated back into the wild. What then do you do with them? Zoo?
With our lions, they very much fall into that category. Mm-hmm. You know, people very often see lion art and say, would you have been able to return them to Africa? And we always say, no, there's huge problems for that because, you know, they've lived on another continent with all sorts of different diseases and biting insects, so they could carry something that isn't necessarily harmful and wouldn't show in a lion, but, you know, a mosquito picks it up and suddenly you wipe out another animal population, an antelope population or something like that. So there's kind of disease and health issues. There's also the fact that these animals have been denied certain skills. They haven't learned to grow up and hunt and catch and all of those things, so they can probably do it, and it wouldn't be impossible, but there would be some that would be so ineffectual that they would probably starve. And then there's the issue that they're very imprinted on people. Now, instinctively, lions, leopards, and other animals like that, they wouldn't just walk into town and look for food in the bins or anything like that. Now, these sorts of animals who are used to being in tiny cages in the center of town and things, they would walk up to people quite likely. They would walk into town. Of course, that poses a huge threat, whereas a lion kind of generally in the wild will instinctively keep its distance from people. So there's a lot of problems with them. These animals that we've just rescued from circuses in Peru have all been mutilated. They've all had their claws cut off. So they've lost their biggest weapon in chasing and catching wildlife anyhow. So there will always be certain animals that cannot go back to the wild. And for those, we do what we can, which is to provide them a habitat as close as possible to going to the wild. Now, the lions, as you know in the film, go to Colorado and they go to these huge enclosures where, through using birth control, they can live in big family groups without producing more and more and overflowing the space. And they have sort of the biggest enclosure is 25 acres. And they can roam, they live in an underground den, they're as independent as possible, they're fed through having food provided from a truck, but it's as close as we can give them to the wild. And it'll be same with the monkeys we've got. You know, they were torn as tiny babies from the wild. They're not parts of the big family groups that look after each other in the wild with primates, but we're enclosing Amazon habitats for them, and so they'll be in the wild. And people often say after lion art, what's gonna, you know, do you want to see rid of all the zoos and things like that? And I think the change of attitude there is that we should stop perpetuating them. We should stop tearing wildlife out of the wild just to fuel the zoo industry and the pet trade. And we should stop deliberately breeding. There will always be animals that get hit on the road, and you know, a wild animal crosses the road, gets hit by a car, it survives, needs veterinary treatment. but it may not be possible for it to go back into the wild. There will be the illegal animals. The drug dealer has got a mountain lion in his basement protecting his drug stash, which is confiscated. Almost certainly can't go back to the wild. So there will always be these animals, these problem animals, these illegal animals. And it's really a case of there should be a lot less captive wildlife. There should be a lot less places with captive wildlife. But the ones we've got should be bigger and better. And going on to the actually protecting wildlife in the wild, yes, I think the world has shown that the nature of human expansion is that if we don't protect it, we will lose the wild. If we don't give these animals space, we will lose them. And so I think it is about ring fencing areas, not necessarily with actual fences, but certainly saying you can't build on these anymore, you can't keep taking them, you can't keep eroding nature, because nature is all of ours, and we're all losing something every time a new development steamrollers a piece of habitat or Everglade in Florida. And so it's going to need controls and it's going to need protection. And I think that it's for people like us to raise the awareness of, you know, the planet we live on is a lot more than just being real estate, that there is value in all of this for our children's children's children to see these bears and these other animals and these, you know, magnificent trees and plants. That's all of ours. It's not for people to completely sell off. And, you know, there, people are realizing we have to protect the Amazon, and that goes for states like Florida as well. It takes an effort to protect these things, but it's worth doing.
So, is there an enclosure or zoo that you do stand by?
I think the where the lions go in Lion Arc, the wild animal sanctuary in Colorado, that's open to the public, and I think that has the finest lion enclosures and program of managing the lions, which I include, you know, building them up into proper prides. I think that's a very, very good example. And I thought, should the public be going to that? And what they've done is they've got this mile-long walkway, and it's over 40 feet off the ground. And so you're not in the faces of the animals. You're not intimidating them. They've got their own space, and that calms them down. They're also very, very big enclosures. Some animals, they've got lions, tigers, bears, wolves there. Some animals you'll get close to. Others you'll see in the distance. And I think that makes the experience of seeing them wonderful and exciting. And it's also good for the animals. So there's an example of somewhere that is open to the public. And I think that certain sanctuaries, you know, real true sanctuaries, are pushing the boundaries like that, giving the animals more and more space, specializing on the animals. One or two zoos in the US are doing that sort of thing as well. For example, Detroit Zoo and Oakland Zoo have done work with just taking in rescued animals. And Detroit Zoo famously handed over their elephants, which were a big draw, but they handed them to a sanctuary in California saying, you know, we should not have elephants in this climate. You know, they've got to live half the year indoors. It's all very nice when the public come and see them in the summer months, but the rest of the months is far, far too cold. They've got to live in concrete pens effectively indoors, and it's terrible for their arthritis. So I think, you know, and they take, say, rescued polar bears instead. Now, I think those are the things we should see changing more and more and more, that places need to specialize on what animals they have, what's suitable to the climate, the habitat, all of those things. And then to people listening, they're probably common sense things. You know, you're in a cold, wet climate. What are you doing with elephants that live in a hot, arid climate? you're in Argentina with a hot, sweltering climate. What the hell have you got a polar bear for? And so I think, you know, there's a sort of a change coming where it's about the responsibility of these places. Far too many of them, and the majority of zoos, safari parks, etc., are just places of entertainment, stockpiling an awful lot of animals.
Well, this is where I wanted to end the recorded interview, right here. I felt that it's a good one. I do wanted to ask you a little bit more about SeaWorld. I actually work at SeaWorld. That's why I brought it up, and I wanted to.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I do work there. I work as a photographer at the front of the park. And I've actually been inside maybe once or twice. I haven't really gone inside and seen everything. And I don't know if you know about their wildlife efforts that they do have. They do rescue animals in the area. I don't know if you knew about that.
I'm not completely familiar with it, but I've heard that. And then many zoos and animal establishments have their good side, bad side. I'm kind of perfect. I think the fact that they've historically captured orcas and other animals and sold them around the world and then keep them in pens, which really just, but I just, they're on a hiding to nothing. They will never make the pens good enough to replicate the sea.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of just wipes away the good, and they've got to wrestle with that side.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. There's I'm conflicted. I'm sort of in the middle. I have people who come into the park. I deal with people too, so you know, I have people who come into the park feel as though they're on the fence too. I have people who come in just to tell other people that SeaWorld is no good, and then I also work with people who swear by it, and from what I see, I feel as though even though that their Killica, which is their biggest orca, is there for, I wouldn't say the wrong reasons, but was given to them under tough circumstances, and we have the whales living in these giant tanks that don't really do much justice to their life style. But from what I see that happens in the back, there is an effort to try to rescue wildlife in Florida within 100 miles from their facility in Orlando. And they do have a reputation in the front of the park, especially with Don Tranchow. With her death, and then with the death of a homeless man at SeaWorld in 99. But I do feel as though they are trying to show everyone in Florida and outside to the world that they do care about sea life. And they do make a pretty good effort for them. They do make a really good effort for it. But as for the whales, as of right now, they don't capture any more whales, is what they say. But they do have the four or five whales in tanks.
Well, I think these things aren't always black and white, but you know, I think that the, like I said before, it's a bit like the corrupt politician, you know, that they're out there doing some good, but they're kind of doing bad, and you can't wipe away the stain. And I think that it is a big business. It probably takes a while to make a kind of radical change, but the good they're doing doesn't actually sit on the same scale as the other animals they've got. So they're going to need to change very, very radically, a clear commitment and things on just moving away from that model. And that's a tough bullet to bite when you've invested all of that money, when you've done all of that. But the choice is moving away. I move to territory I'm much more familiar with than the ins and outs of SeaWorld. But with the circuses, the growth industry is animal-free entertainment. It's absolutely clear-cut economically. But the ones who hang on and hang on, with the wild animals particularly, but also all animals, are killing their industry. And they're killing an industry where, you know, even someone like Ringlings, 13 minutes of their two-hour show is wild animals. The rest is either domestic animals or predominantly human acts. And within that industry, the change has to be retool, get with you using human acts. Now, that's a bit tougher for SeaWorld to retool, but there has to be ways of doing it, because it's about a radical change and not enslaving these magnificent animals in these tiny pools to perform for people.
With them now, they do perform, and I guess they are miles away from putting them back into the wild, because they're so assimilated with human interaction as of right now. I mean, it did happen before with the whale from Free Willy. I don't know if you know the movie.
Keiko the whale. It went to Norway, didn't it?
Yeah. It went to Norway, and it eventually lived out its years until 2003, when he passed. Is there a chance for those whales at SeaWorld to eventually move on into the wild?
I think that, I mean, given the wealth of SeaWorld, given the wealth of the conservation movement that's particularly sort of campaigns on that, that I would have thought that some sort of offshore enclosure. I mean, there's many dolphins in Swim with Dolphin programs that are in offshore enclosures now, so they're released in a relatively natural habitat.
SeaWorld.
Many are questionably obtained. But I would have thought that some form of offshore retirement for those animals, and at least not perpetuating it with any more breeding or anything, would be their future. It's probably unlikely they can just go back to the wild, because of all the reasons that you say, with the imprinting and the lack of skills, and their communication skills will be very damaged. I mean, they will not communicate in the same way, I would doubt, because they're in these echoey tanks. You know, we've all seen how going deaf impacts on people's speech and things like that. But there must be something, there's got to be something between the two. For our lions, it's the enclosures in Colorado. It isn't the wild, but it's as close as we can do, and they're retired, and they don't have to perform, and if they come wandering out and you see them, that's great. And there's got to be that middle ground for those animals. And I would have thought SeaWorld has the wealth to say, we've had a good innings with these animals, they've earned us an awful lot of money over the years, then let's retire them and let's spend the last money on retiring them. Big thing for them to have to do, but it's the right thing.
Well, I wanted to thank you for spending time with me and talking to me about you know, your film and SeaWorld and other of your adventures. I just hope everything comes out well for you, especially down in South America. And I guess I'll talk. No problem. I guess I'll speak to you when you come up with that TV show.
February in Gainesville, Florida.
For Lionel, correct?
Yeah, at the Cinema Verde Environmental Arts and Film Festival.
Oh yeah. Yeah, if you want to, let me grab my mic. Yeah, I know Lori was
talking. I'll just say where we've got, because we've got a few screenings coming up.
Okay. Go ahead, plug away. You can plug anything that you want in here.
Thank you. Yeah, we've got a few screenings of Lion Art coming up. We're on the 14th of February. We're at the Cinema Verde Environmental Arts and Film Festival. That's in Gainesville, Florida, and it's on Saturday the 14th, 1 p.m. Ideal way to spend Valentine's Day, we feel. Then we're at the Boulder International Film Festival a couple of weeks later, in March. And then in April, we hope to be screening in selected U.S. cities, sort of one-off screenings with Q&As in most big cities. We'll be back to Florida, but we'll be doing New York, Chicago, Boston, Atlanta, and so on. So cities all across the U.S. So if people follow us on either lionartthemovie.com or our Facebook, they can get details of those as they come out.
Thank you very much for, you know, once again, taking your time out.